You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up at 6 on 1A+, UN inspectors arrive at an occupied Ukrainian nuclear plant, while Russia mourns a former leader. Those stories and more at 6 o'clock on 1A+. Now, President Joe Biden appeared last night at Independence National Historical Park in Philadelphia. He spoke to the nation about ongoing threats to democracy, calling out the danger he sees from former President Donald Trump and extreme so-called MAGA Republicans. He also urged citizens to act.
I'm asking our nation to come together, unite behind the single purpose of defending our democracy regardless of your ideology.
We're going to dig into the language and messaging used by President Biden to make his case last night, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you watch this speech last night? What were your thoughts and reactions? How did it land with you? How did it make you feel? Are you also worried about the fate of American democracy right now? And if you were a Republican voter, what did you make of the president's distinction between mainstream and MAGA Republicans? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Mike Wagner is a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be with you.
Good to have you back. And Mike, I'm curious right off the bat about what you think of the timing of this speech. Why do you think the White House chose to hold this address at this moment?
Well, Labor Day is a traditional entry into election season during election years. And so it's a way to kind of frame the kickoff of election season to make an argument that democracy is on the ballot as compared to the traditional and typical debates between Republicans and Democrats about issues of policy and symbolic ideas of what it means to be American. And instead, the president is saying, there are forces in the Republican Party that, in his words, are determined to take this country backwards. And he is talking about policy there, and then he's talking about the kind of consistent choices made by many elements of the Republican Party that continue not to accept the results of the 2020 election. And is tying that to efforts to change election rules in a variety of states, many of them what we would call presidential swing states, which could affect how the next presidential election comes out in a couple of years.
A lot of lofty talk from President Biden last night about democracy and the experiment of American democracy. And I'd imagine that the Independence Hall setting was probably chosen to echo that.
Oh, of course. Professional politicians at the level of presidents typically don't engage in major speech making without thinking about the symbolic nature of how they're doing things. And so being at Independence Hall and giving the speech, you know, in Philadelphia, right as the election fall campaign for the general election moves into full swing are clear strategic choices on the president's behalf.
As you mentioned from early on in the speech, President Biden zeroed in on President Trump and what he called the MAGA wing of the Republican Party. I want to take a listen to him from last night making that point.
Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic. Now, I want to be very clear up front. Not every Republican, not even the majority of Republicans, are MAGA Republicans. Not every Republican embraces their extreme ideology. I know, because I've been able to work with these mainstream Republicans. But there's no question that the Republican Party today is dominated, driven, and intimidated by Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans. And that is a threat to this country.
There's a couple points there, Mike, that I want to get into with that quote. First up, since taking office, President Biden has not said Donald Trump's name very often at all. Last night, multiple times. What do you make of that?
Well, I think part of the reason is that President Trump, or former President Trump, has been making more noise on his own, but has also been in the news for the raid on Mar-a-Lago, where he lives in Florida, and his keeping of top secret documents that he wasn't supposed to be keeping. And so there, he's been back in the news. He's, of course, continuing to make it sound like he is planning to run for president again. He has made several key endorsements, including in our own state, in a lot of important races that are a part of the midterms. And so as he's becoming a greater part of the political conversation again, it's not surprising that President Biden is kind of engaging former President Trump by name more than he had when he first took office.
We're talking with Mike Wagner right now, professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, looking back at President Biden's address last night about what he sees as threats to American democracy. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What did you think of the speech last night and the coverage and reaction since then? Let us know at 800-642-1234. And Mike, another big part of President Biden's speech was driving home that term MAGA Republicans, really distinguishing that as a wing of the party and mainstream Republicans as a different group. What do you think about that approach that he took?
I think it's been a hallmark of Biden's career to try to find ways to work with the other party, which for him is the Republican Party, since he's a Democrat. And he's been an institutionalist. He has been a big believer in the ability of individual lawmakers across party lines to compromise. And I think it seems to fundamentally believe that having a two-party system with robust debate is a good thing. I think he feels it's politically important and probably politically wise not to paint the opposition party with one brush, especially since a lot of elections, including his own, are often very close in the United States and require sometimes persuading a small percentage of voters in the other party to support you or to stay home, and to persuade sometimes independent voters or infrequent voters to support you. And many folks in the United States tend to view the two parties as equally problematic and equally to blame for the nation's problems. And so singling the entirety of one out is a far riskier strategy than saying there's a group of people in the Republican Party that are the problem, which is the tack that Biden took yesterday.
Do you think that that distinction sort of aligns with the political reality among the Republican base? Do you think it'll be received as, oh, yes, these MAGA Republicans are different than myself? What do you think?
No, I don't think that most Republicans will see the distinction. I think some will, but I think most won't. And, you know, I think President Biden was perhaps even too generous, but in some respects, when he said it's not a majority of Republicans, whereas in our own state, according to the most recent Marquette Law School poll, more than half of Republicans who were polled in that said that they were either not too confident or not at all confident that the votes were counted accurately in the 2020 presidential election. And these are the folks that President Biden is talking about, which is a majority of Republicans in our state.
Here's some more of Biden laying out the threats that he sees from a specific wings of the Republican Party last night. Here's a listen.
MAGA forces are determined to take this country backwards to an America where there is no right to choose, no right to privacy, no right to contraception, no right to marry who you love. They promote authoritarian leaders and they fan the flames of political violence that are a threat to our personal rights, to the pursuit of justice, to the rule of law, to the very soul of this country.
The word authoritarian used there. Recently, President Biden also used the term semi-fascism. People on the right pointing that out as divisive, pointing that out as a little aggressive. Mike, what do you make of that sort of back and forth and that escalation in the president's language?
I would say that, you know, President Biden, as John Harwood said on CNN today, which ended up being his last day on CNN after the reporter said this, President Biden is saying things that are true. He's saying things that are true about large swaths of the Republican Party not accepting the results of the 2020 election and supporting people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. The leader of the party is promising to and saying he is financially supporting some of the people who are now facing legal trouble for the attempted dissident coup on the United States on January 6th. And so I think it's a little bit of pearl clutching to say that it's divisive to call people who stormed the Capitol and refused to believe the legitimate results of an election to be hard on them. It's appropriate to be hard on people who don't believe that the president won the election.
And there's also been a lot of chatter in the day after the speech and a lot of defense from the White House press office saying that this was not a political speech, and other folks saying, yes, it was political. Is that a significant issue at this point, or is that sort of missing the point of this address?
I think it's missing the point of the address. I mean, anytime any president speaks, it's political. It's about the struggle for power and resources and who gets what, when, and how. And that is what politics is about. And the president is a politician. And that's not a bad thing, right? We need people to be engaged with the struggle for power and resources and think about those issues and deliberate about them and make hard choices about them. And so, I think it's sort of silly to say that it wasn't a political speech. And as in the clip you even just played, the speech wasn't just about the acceptance of free and fair elections and impediments to free and fair elections. The speech was about abortion and same-sex marriage and other issues that are very important to our country, to be sure, but are not the same thing as do we have free and fair elections that elevate the rightful winner into the offices that they've won.
We're talking with Mike Wagner from UW-Madison about President Biden's language and messaging in a national speech last night in Philadelphia. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions, comments do you have about the speech? Do you agree with the points the president made about democracy being in danger? Do you disagree? What else would you like to hear from President Biden last night? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter in for Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with UW-Madison's Mike Wagner, professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication. We're analyzing a speech last night by President Joe Biden speaking in Philadelphia about threats to democracy, specifically as he sees them from Donald Trump and what he called the extremist wing of the Republican Party. And Mike, you mentioned we are going into midterm season, and there could be a question for Democrats about whether they focus their campaigning on recent legislative wins, things like gun policy and climate change, or if they focus on these bigger picture issues of democracy. Do you think President Biden was sort of showing last night that, hey, candidates, you can do both?
I think so. I think that part of the message was that the election could be framed as one where democracy is on the ballot. I think that we've seen in more recent primaries and special elections in various places around the country that other issues are more central in more voters' minds, especially the abortion issue after the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe versus Wade, and some states moving aggressively to outlaw legal abortions, and other states moving in the other direction to make them more accessible as a part of a person's health care. And so I think that that's probably a bigger issue in the minds of most voters, at least right now. But President Biden is pointing out that part of the hard work of democracy is done in the trenches, doing things that are minimum bars to clear, such as counting the ballots accurately, fairly, and transparently, and then having the person who won go to the office that they've won, and the person who lost admitting they lost and conceding defeat. And these are norms that President Biden and many others are calling on the country to get back to in pretty short order.
That term free and fair was almost a refrain in his speech last night, both referring to
yes.
Elections and society at large.
That's right. It was. And there are lots of ways to think about what it means to have a free and fair democracy. Our own research group that I direct on our campus recently published an article led by Jordan Foley, one of our graduate students at the time, that found that in Wisconsin, black voters tend to have longer commutes to where they vote, and Hispanic voters in Wisconsin tend to wait in line longer to vote. And so part of a free and fair democracy ought to be equal access to the ballot and a fair and equitable access to voting in the first place. And we see that in our state, we don't have that. We do have and have had verified in multiple ways an accurate counting of the ballots. And yet the thing that's getting debated and raised by people like former President Trump, former Justice Gableman in our state, are questions about the accuracy of the election, which is an issue where there really aren't questions. And we're not focusing on other ways we could make our democracy more free and more fair.
And it was not all darkness in President Biden's speech. He pointed out a lot of problems that he sees, but there was also a hopeful wrap up to this one. What are some of the ways you saw him building a little bit of hope and optimism?
President Biden regularly says things like he said last night when he said, "I know this nation, I know the American people, I know your courage, I know your hearts," and then kind of laid through a litany of things that the president wants to say that Americans believing in the rule of law, and free and fair elections, rejecting violence, being honest and decent. These are, kind of traditional and typical, rabble-rousing, positive, positive campaigning kinds of things that candidates do, because it's often a motivator, especially for people in the same party as the person who's doing the talking about those kinds of things.
We're talking with Mike Wagner from UW-Madison about President Biden's address to the nation last night. Also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones now. We have Paul with us in Eau Claire. Hi, Paul.
Hi. How are you?
Doing all right. What did you want to bring up?
Oh, just that I've been to college a couple times, and I'm a mega Republican, and I don't think Biden's really looking out for me. I've never made $125,000 a year. And as far as the 2020 election goes, the only person I know who's been charged with a felony for illegal voting was the guy who wanted to show the problems with My Vote Wisconsin and the inconsistencies there. That's what I wanted to say.
So, Paul, just to follow up, sounds like your vote is guided a little more by policy than election issues. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I guess that would be safe to say.
Gotcha. Paul, thanks for calling in and sharing that. And Mike, what do you think about Paul's comments and how that figures into the way the Democrats are approaching these midterm elections?
I think one issue all presidents have is to persuade people, especially people who are in the other political party, that they are fighting for them. President Biden, not much, but a couple of times in his speech yesterday, noted that one time saying, he's not just the president of those who voted for him, but of people in red states and blue states and people in between. But it's harder to make the case that political candidates are doing things that are approved and favored by folks on the other side, right? Especially people who vote based on policy, right? President Biden is a pro-choice, for example, Democrat, and that's not likely to persuade a lot of Republicans to want to support him, because their views would be the complete opposite on that issue, an issue that's dominating a lot of election discourse. And so it's probably not the case that President Biden's speech did much on the policy side to persuade people who disagree with him, but instead was trying to chart a course for himself and members of his own party to campaign in this election and to hopefully sway, from his point of view, middle of the road voters who may not like everything Biden has done, who may say, "I don't like the student loan forgiveness that just happened because I don't get it myself," or something like that. But to say, "I do think that we need to stop pretending that the 2020 election wasn't accurately decided." It's pretend to keep indulging that conversation, and there's no point to it. And maybe to do that, we need to have an election that you know, from President Biden's point of view, makes it easier for Democrats to get into positions to be the folks who are shaping election laws for the foreseeable future.
Paul, thanks for that call. Time for one more call. We have Dennis with us in Two Rivers. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I agree with some of what Biden says. Trump had some good ideas, but the problem is a lot of Trump supporters figure on two things. One, Trump can do no wrong and say nothing wrong. Belief number two is if Trump says or does something wrong, refer back to belief number one. It doesn't make sense.
Dennis, thanks for the call. And Mike, that's a big issue now, certainly with the Justice Department's investigation into the former president. What are you watching for in terms of how durable that support for Donald Trump is?
That's a great point. His reputation took a little bit of a hit in the initial days after some of the initial action from the Justice Department and some of the more dramatic elements of the January 6th commission. But a lot of that has dissipated, and people tend to revert to their partisan priors. And so Donald Trump hasn't lost very much support at all in the Republican Party. And that's not likely to happen unless more Republican lawmakers start to say he's not the person for us. And it needs to be more than people like Liz Cheney, who are on their way out politically, you know, losing their own primaries. It needs to be folks who are durable leaders in the party if President Trump's reputation in his party is to take a durable and sustained hit.
We'll have to leave it there. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Mike Wagner is a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about President Biden's speech last night outlining threats to democracy in the U.S. It is back to school season as parents are getting their children ready for the return to the classroom. For some, it can be difficult to drop off and say goodbye each morning. And for others, it might be a secret relief after a summer of all-day supervision. Parenting is hard, and we've developed a culture around parenting in the U.S. that's often high pressure and high stakes. Our guest today has a new book out looking at how that parenting culture has changed over time and how we can navigate it. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What has your experience with parenting been like? What are some of the biggest positives and negatives? Do you raise your children differently than your parents raised you? And if you don't have kids, what do you think about the culture around parenting? Are you a little intimidated by it, or are you excited to have kids of your own? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Andrew Bomback is an associate professor of medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. He's the author of the new book, Long Days, Short Years, A Cultural History of Modern Parenting. Dr. Bomback, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited for this discussion.
One of the first big points you make in your book is about the word parent itself. You note that these days we can use parent as a verb, but that was only the case beginning in about the 1970s. Why was that an interesting sort of starting point for you to look into?
So actually the first use of parent as a verb, according to the dictionaries, was the 1950s, but for about 20 years it wasn't really used. And it was really, as you said, in the 70s when people started to talk about parenting as a verb. And now the use of parent as a verb actually exceeds the use of parent as a noun. And to me, that's interesting because it really signifies a shift in the way people feel about raising kids. It's no longer just, being a parent, like a role that you're sort of growing into. It's rather a skill that you have to work at. And by making parenting a verb, it implies that you should be working at it, and you can be doing a better job than you're doing just by putting more and more work and in many instances, more and more money into the task at hand.
And what do you think are some of the factors that drove that shift looking at parenting as more of a learned skill?
Well, I think there's a number of factors, and all of these factors are discussed in my book. But I think one of the biggest factors is that as parents today, we're looking at a world that our kids are going to inherit that's not necessarily as good as the one that we grew up in and the one that we're currently in. So by that, I mean, kids who are growing up to become adults now are one of the first generations to be expected to make less money than their parents. So there's a shrinking economic pot. We know that our kids are inheriting an earth that is sicker and sicker due to changes in the climate. We know that our kids are entering a country that's really rife with a lot of division, and just the overall outlook does appear to be grimmer. And so what do you do if you're a parent who's raising kids and looking into that future? It seems to put a lot of pressure on parents to try to prepare our kids as best we can for this. And, you know, there are different ways you can prepare kids, but one of the ways that parents have sort of latched onto is to try to cultivate their kids into the best possible versions, or what they think are the best possible versions, the best college entrances, the best resumes, you know, the 20 extracurricular activities, basically saying that by the time they hit, you know, adulthood, I will have done everything I can. They can never blame me for giving them every opportunity to succeed. And that sort of internal pressure that parents are putting on themselves, to me, is a very modern phenomenon. And it's based, I think, on this anxiety about the world that our kids are inheriting.
And I'd imagine that for parents to fully deliver on some of those promises, it takes things like time and money. Is that correct?
It takes time and money, and it takes exorbitant amounts of each. So one of the statistics that I cite early in the book, which really astounded me when I first read it, is that a working mother today spends as much time and much more money, even with adjustments for inflation, than a stay-at-home mom did in the 70s in terms of raising kids. And so if you just sort of do the math, especially with the time component of this, the fact that a working mom is giving the exact same amount of hours in raising her kids that a stay-at-home mom did in the 70s, it means that a working mom comes home and basically as soon as she comes home, she's on the clock for a totally new job. And that clock does not stop until the kids leave the house the next day for school, and then mom's back on the clock for her job. So it's basically this idea that parenting is a 24-hour day, 7-day a week, 365-day a year job, where there's no off switch for parents now. And you know, it's why some parents, when I talk to them, say, you know, the weekends are not very restful for me. Like, the weekends is just my second job, and it's actually a harder job than my regular job.
We're talking with Dr. Andrew Bomback right now, author of the new book, Long Days, Short Years, A Cultural History of Modern Parenting. We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. Your experiences with parenting, good or bad, your questions for our guest, 800-642-1234. And Dr. Bomback, one of the common questions that parents have been asking themselves for many, many decades is what they can control in their kids' lives and the way they parent them, and what they cannot control. Has our sense of what is under our control for our kids changed a lot over the years, do you think?
Well, it's a really interesting question, because if you look at the general trend of parenting, specifically in this country, every generation of parents is trying to exert more control over their kids than the previous generation. So if you go back to kids who were being raised 200 years ago, they had so much more independence than kids who are being raised now. And even within generations. So, you know, this current generation has a lot less independence than my generation as kids. Parents are, you know, in a position where they really want to control what they think they can control. But interestingly, they don't try to control what they know they can control. So to give an example, going back to the, you know, the earliest parents, the Puritans, you know, their kids were dying of infection, but they actually had no ability to control infection. So what they did was they tried to control morality and sin. So parents in the 70s and 80s, you know, there are things that they were afraid of, you know, nuclear war, they're afraid of the change in the family dynamics with women entering the workspace. So what do they focus on? Well, they focus on preventing kidnappings. They focus on preventing their kids from using drugs, because those are very tangible targets that they can hit. If you go to parents today, as I said, there are a lot of things that are outside of our control. You know, a lot of parents are worried about the way the world is changing. But what do we focus on? Well, we focus on let's get our kids into the top college rather than saying, can we get our kids to sort of lead us to a more equal society, to a society that protects the planet better. So again, when you look at parental anxieties and how it fuels their desire for control, there's always a subtext that they're going to try to control what is appearing to be a relatively easy target.
And that's an interesting point you make, that a lot of parenting practices might be driven by parental anxieties rather than what's actually best for the kids.
Yeah, and I think that's always been the case, and it's just gotten more and more pronounced over the last 50 years because parents in general today are much more anxious than they were, you know, 40, 50 years ago. You can see it just in the dominant parental advice book. So, you know, 50 years ago, the best-selling advice book was Dr. Spock. And Dr. Spock's main message to parents was relax, trust yourself. You know a lot more than you think you do, and trust your instincts. If you look at the dominant themes of today's parenting books, they're almost the exact opposite. They're saying, you're coming to us in crisis. You clearly don't know what you're doing. So forget your instincts. We're going to give you a very detailed plan, even in some cases, a written out script on how to talk to your kids. And this is how you'll get through parenting. So it goes from, 50 years ago, a more relaxed, go with the flow, trust your instincts, to now sort of fueling that anxiety by saying, do the opposite of your instincts. Follow this laid out blueprint in this book that you've just purchased.
Let's go to the calls of the phones now at 800-642-1234. Bill is with us in La Crosse. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I understood your beginning paragraph or two where you said that the future of the children may be more difficult than our times. And I think that's right. But in parents, I see them shielding their kids and making them comfortable and protecting them from all discomfort and problems. While I think the opposite should be, they should be trying to help them learn how to deal with difficulties and discomfort and skin knees and so forth.
Bill, thanks for the call. Dr. Bomback, what do you think about Bill's point about discomfort and its role in parenting?
Yeah, I think Bill's point is really important because, you know, kids are not born being anxious. Kids are not born being scared of some of the things we talked about. They're going to follow the model that their parents set. And if we shield them from these realities, if we try to basically put on blinders to some of these very important issues, we're not doing our role as parents. So our role as parents is to model behaviors. It's our role as parents, as Brené Brown once said, is to be the adults that we want our kids to someday be. And so we are constantly modeling behaviors for our children. And that's probably the most important task of being a parent, is to set that kind of example. And so while, you know, obviously all parents can empathize with this feeling that you want to be protective and secure your kids and make sure they're not hurt, there's a way to keep them safe, but also make sure they're knowledgeable and exposed to so many of these important issues. And there's also a way to model how to respond to those issues. And I think that's sort of what the call is for modern parents now, in terms of showing that example.
We're talking with Dr. Andrew Bomback from the Columbia University Medical Center about his new book, Long Days, Short Years, A Cultural History of Modern Parenting. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever sought parenting advice? Where did you look? Who did you turn to? Was that advice helpful? If you have kids, what surprised you the most about the parenting experience, good or bad? What suggestions do you have for new parents? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Dr. Andrew Bomback, Associate Professor of Medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. His new book is called Long Days, Short Years, A Cultural History of Modern Parenting. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Joe in Fond du Lac. Hi, Joe.
Yes, my comment is, you know, I think the parents are worse than the children. Just, you know, sometimes turn off Facebook. Don't always worry about what your neighbor is doing. Don't try to keep up with the Joneses. We are parents. Parenting has happened for 30,000 years or 50,000 years or whatever since the cavemen. I think parents just have to chill out, turn off the electronics, and do what you think is best for your child.
Joe, thanks for the call. And Dr. Bomback, you talk about the issue of screens being a new one in your book. What kind of questions are they bringing up for the way we take care of our kids and for ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, at first I want to just sort of get to something that Joe mentioned, which is that the internet, Facebook, social media really has added a whole new level of pressure for parents, specifically the idea of parent shaming. So there used to be parent shaming for you know, for generations. It's been essentially the parents and the in-laws of the current parents, so the grandparents, giving a little bit of shaming to the parents if they felt like the job wasn't being done perfectly. But now with social media, you can get parent shamed from all directions, from people you've never even met before. And parent shaming comes in very different versions. You know, you can get parent shamed directly saying like, oh, you should never let your kids watch this show, or you should have never let your kids do X, Y, and Z. But you can also get parent shamed on social media by somebody posting what they're doing with their kids and saying, this is the right way to do it. Look how happy my family is, and why are, and the subtext of why aren't you as good as us? So now I feel like parent shaming is coming from all directions, not just in a vertical fashion from the prior generation of parents, but from this intragenerational parent shaming, which is a really new phenomenon that the internet has made particularly hard on parents. And then to your other point, screens are a whole new challenge for parents that this generation is really the first to have to deal with in a pervasive way. Yes, when I grew up, we had screens in terms of televisions, and I know that my parents struggled with how much television my siblings and I consumed, and they worked hard to limit how much TV we were exposed to. But there's so much more than TV now, and kids are basically living in a screen-filled world, basically at every turn. And it goes back to what we talked about earlier in terms of parents as role models. You as a parent are really responsible for modeling for your kids how to responsibly use screens. So it can be something as, you know, basic as anytime we're sitting down for a family meal, dinner or lunch or breakfast, it's a screen-free environment so that we're all connected to each other and we're all present for each other and we can actually communicate without using screens in our peripheries. So that you know, is one very simple way. It can be other things like just setting time limits on screens for your kids. I heard from a parenting coach a great piece of advice, which is you should never let your kids use a screen when they're outdoors so that they know how important it is to be you know, interacting with the outdoor world without a screen in their way. So each group of parents is going to have to figure out how they want to manage screens. But the most important place to start is to be responsible with screens yourself as an adult.
Joe, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Vivian in Green Bay. Vivian, hi.
Parental responsibility for how the children, quote, turn out. My children are fine as adults, but just in their last years, 16, 17 years old, I stopped holding myself accountable for their behaviors because I'd been defeated, sort of, and I decided, okay, I've given them all the skills I can give them, and they make choices too.
Thank you for sharing that. Dr. Bomback, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, this is an interesting phenomenon of parent. I read somewhere that parenting is like the most toxic relationship you can imagine because you spend all this time building up this really intimate relationship where the goal is to get them to break up with you, right? The goal is that by the time they turn 18, 19, 20, they're ready to say, okay, I can do this without you. And so, you know, I think what the caller is saying is really – important. Like sometimes success as a parent is to say, I've prepared you for this. You can do it now. I've done everything I can. And now it's your turn to take the lead. And if you've done, you know, the honest job of parenting and really done all the work that you feel like was invested in you to get your kids to that point, you have every right to say that.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We touched a little bit on the online parenting sphere. Some of that is carefully curated social media feeds. Other parts of it are those advice blogs, and that stems from decades of advice, parenting advice being a little industry in its own. How did that rise up and how has it changed?
Yeah, well, I mean, it starts primarily from the fact that there's a market. So all these books and blogs and podcasts, they wouldn't exist if there wasn't a market of very eager parents to consume these advice resources. And I think one of the big shifts is that we're looking for input on parenting from sources that normally would not be considered traditional experts. So, you know, if you think about who should be giving advice on parenting, the most logical answer is people who were parents. So we should be looking to older generations for their advice. We almost never hear from those sources of information in terms of blogs and books and podcasts. Now it's either parents who are currently parenting, who are right in the thick of things, but we also have neurobiologists, we have game theorists, we have social economists, we have biostatisticians, we have all these outside consultants to the parenting sphere giving their input. And it's sort of, you know, like parenting is this business in distress, and you ask for outside consultants to give advice. To me, it signals that there's this big SOS cry coming up from parents saying, we're desperate for help. We'll look everywhere for help. And to me, I think this deluge of parenting advice can be very reassuring if you find the right piece of advice, but it can be really upsetting to parents if they spend all their time looking and they still haven't found the thing that actually helps their family.
We just have about a minute left. If people are feeling worn down by that competition and like they're not doing it right, what are some things you'd encourage them to keep in mind to stay hopeful?
Well, the first thing I would say is read my book, because one of the reasons why I wrote this book is that I was feeling to some degree worn down and upset about what I was doing as a parent. And that's where I found myself doing a lot of research about this and writing about this. And it helped me to see that I was not alone and that this is a real trend in parenting, that parents in general are getting more exhausted, more anxious, more stressed out about the job. So I would hope that your listeners can find some solace in what I've written. But I think the biggest message I took from all my work in this, in terms of how I apply it to my own family, is that you have to find resources that actually work for the children in your house. So you can read, you know, all the books in the world, but if they don't actually give advice that you think will work for your kids, don't use them. So once you know your kids really well, you'll be able to say, okay, this book's chapter will work, but these books' other chapters will not work for my kids. And so I recommend trying to pick and choose the ones that you think are actually suited for the people in your family.
And that's all the time we have. Dr. Bomback, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, and I hope I can connect with your listeners again.
That was Dr. Andrew Bomback, author of the new book, Long Days, Short Years, A Cultural History of Modern Parenting. Stay tuned. This is Central Time.